Hello, I'm Lilian Ahmadu. Welcome to Health Chat. In a peer-reviewed research published recently in the American Journal of Therapeutics, a group of medical and scientific experts from the United States and around the world have concluded that ivermectin is an effective prevention and treatment for COVID-19. Ivermectin is a broad-spectrum antiparasitic agent included in WHO essential medicines list for several parasitic diseases. Since last year, the drug has been used in some countries to fight the coronavirus in patients. However, the move has led to some controversy, as many experts disagree with its efficacy and safety for COVID-19. The US FDA has not approved ivermectin, which it says is not an antiviral to prevent or treat COVID-19. But according to the research led by the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, FLCCC, ivermectin should be adopted globally to fight the pandemic. For more on the subject, I spoke with Dr. Pierre Corey, Chief Medical Officer of the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance. Take a listen.
Dr. Pierre Corey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You, along with a team of experts, conducted a peer review research regarding ivermectin. The product showed some positive results in the fight against COVID. Before we get into the research, would you explain to us what ivermectin is, please?
Sure. So ivermectin is a very well-known medication, known really for combating parasites. In fact, it's sort of a very famous medication because it transformed the health status of a good portion of the globe after it was invented. It actually, the discoverers won the Nobel Prize because it eradicated these endemic parasitic infections from much of Africa, Southeast Asia, South America. So it's a highly effective parasitic, antiparasitic. But what's been known for about 10 years, it also has this tremendous activity against numerous viruses. Multiple studies over about 10 years show that it works against Zika and dengue and West Nile, all in the lab. There's not good clinical data yet on those viruses, but certainly it's known now as an antiviral agent.
So it's been used in humans as well as animals, am I correct?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, it not only works in humans, it also works in animals. It's a very common veterinary drug, but it's also a very common human drug. Like many medications are used in both. Ivermectin's another one.
What drew your attention to ivermectin in fighting COVID-19?
So the organization I'm a part of, it's a close group of colleagues. We're some of the most highly published physicians in our specialty. We're well known as thought leaders. We've contributed a number of advances to medicine over the decades. And we got together and we've just studied every aspect of COVID that we could for our patients. And we've really closely followed all the trials around a number of therapeutics. And around October, Professor Marek, my colleague and a mentor, he kind of founded our group. He saw what I would call a signal around ivermectin. Only in October, many people have been talking about ivermectin since the spring and summer. But he started to see the first set of trials, which kind of broke free from all of the other trials, which is so many of the other things that we've studied are really have very unsatisfying results. But ivermectin was like consistently positive in those first few trials. And we just started to look for more trials, and the trials all just came out in a row, and they started to line up, and the data signal just got stronger and stronger.
What did the trial entail, and what were the results in a nutshell?
One, the most current list is that there's 50 trials. I try to focus on two sets. One of them are randomized controlled trials, and the other are what are called observational trials. Just in the randomized controlled trials alone, you see repeated results showing dramatic reductions in death rates. So survival is greatly increased when you use ivermectin. The need for hospitalization is greatly decreased. The time to recovery is greatly decreased, as well as the time until viral clearance. And so that's just in the treatment trials. There's a whole other set of trials which looks at prevention. You know, ivermectin seems to block this. It attaches to the what's called the spike protein, and it prevents entry. And so patients who are on ivermectin, this has been shown in country-by-country analysis as well, in the, many of the countries where they have routine ivermectin prophylaxis, the case rates and deaths are far lower than in other countries. And you see that in the trials. People who take ivermectin regularly, their chances of getting COVID are oftentimes in the low single digits. And then sometimes in the trials that show when you take it every week, nobody gets COVID. And so it's pretty dramatic results in the prevention as well as the treatment.
Has it been used outside of a trial?
Yeah, so that the evidence of the efficacy in what we call the real world is astonishing at this point. So the best, most recent example is Mexico. So the entire what's called the Social Security system of Mexico, which is their outpatient health structure or system, they adopted ivermectin in a test and treat protocol starting in late December when their hospitals were overrun. Anyone who tested positive got ivermectin. Right now, their hospitals are empty. They're having little problem. The death rates are now in society, the death rates are approaching pre-pandemic levels. And that's just Mexico. We see that in Panama. We're seeing that now in some states in India. We're seeing the curves start to change. But there's numerous examples in Uruguay as well. And I just have to say that, you know, a lot of it was due to our work and our advocacy. So we've held a number of international panels where we've had human rights experts, we've had clinical experts, where we've tried to disseminate the knowledge of ivermectin. And we see that in a lot of the public health agencies in those countries, they cite our work as well as the work of others. And so it's very satisfying to see the really positive effects in multiple countries.
I know personally I've heard of at least one person who used it, was treated with ivermectin, and that was in Nigeria. The WHO has advised against using ivermectin. Why do you think so? What is your reaction to the WHO's recommending people not to use ivermectin for COVID?
So what I want to say to that, first of all, is that is really the problem that my group and other groups are trying to address, which is that there are many critical therapies that are not being recognized. Ivermectin is just one example, but we know of a number of effective therapies that are not given the attention they deserve and or the research and support and guidance. And so ivermectin is one of them, but it's becoming a real problem. And so why do I think they haven't? Well, I can tell you, we believe that we've done the work that they haven't. We've done a comprehensive review of all of the emerging evidence. And when you look at the totality of the evidence, it's clear. It's clear that this is a highly effective treatment. And I would say that many of those agencies, they just haven't kept up with the emerging evidence. I mean, it requires a really focused and sustained effort. And we're seeing the recommendations, they're based on really a very distinct minority of the available evidence base. And so that's probably the most glaring reason, is that the focus does not seem to be fully on the wide spectrum of available options. And ivermectin is one of them. More attention needs to be paid to it. And that's what we're trying to do as a group, bring attention to those therapies, which are critical for the patients. I mean, patients are dying. They're suffering. They need early treatment. And this is one, this is like a huge sea change because it's an early treatment option, which we haven't had.
Just to clarify, the WHO recommends against the use of the drug except within clinical trials. When do we move from clinical trials to real life usage?
So that would be a question for them. We have all moved on from them. I would say that position of the WHO, like I said, is behind the times and it's not keeping up with the evidence. If you look at not only our group's review paper, there are a number of other groups, independent panels around the world showing that that WHO position is increasingly isolated. There's a group from the UK, an international collaboration of 65 different specialists and researchers who formed a guideline. They recommended it. A review panel, an expert panel in Italy, in Spain and in Japan, the senior author was Satoshi Omura, who's a Nobel Prize winner. So you have a number of independent expert panels who are coming to the same conclusion.
So who's eligible to use it at this stage?
So ivermectin is one of the safest medicines known in history. So it's been given 4 billion times over almost four decades. In a recent review of the medicine by a world-renowned French toxicologist, his statement was that severe side effects are unequivocally and exceedingly rare. It can be taken by children, babies, any age. It has not been shown to be harmful. In pregnant women, there's a question. Generally, it's thought that it's safe, although as with any other medicine in pregnancy, you never really have sufficient data. But it's generally considered one of the safest medicines. And so there really are no concerns to treating someone with ivermectin. You know, granted, in COVID, most of the children, young people tolerated very well. And so whether to treat or not is a question for the physician, but certainly it's safe to treat.
What do you hope to accomplish in the short and long run with regards to this medicine and in the fight against COVID?
So I would say for the group, what we hope to accomplish is to uphold the oath that we took as physicians, which is to deliver the best care and the best evidence possible. And part of that oath is educating yourself as to the data. The data for ivermectin, at this point, you have 24 randomized controlled trials. It sits on a very large evidence base. It's unequivocal when you look at the totality of the evidence from randomized to observation to epidemiologic. It should be the standard of care. And that is what we hope to accomplish, is to help our patients and deliver the best care possible. That is our only goal. Again, we're a nonprofit organization. We profit nothing except trying to do the right thing for our patients. I mean, we happen to be experts in the field. And as an expert in the field, we're actually responsible to share our knowledge with society. And so we're trying to uphold our core mission as physicians and as an organization.
Your group believe that ivermectin can end the pandemic. At least that was a part of the statement that was released. How so? And isn't it a bit ambitious?
It's not a belief, right? Because we see it. So again, I'll bring our attention back to Mexico, because that is the most dramatic example. If you look at Mexico right now, compared to December, when they started a national test and treat strategy centered around ivermectin, their hospitals were full and overrunning. They were in what is essentially a humanitarian crisis, the same state that India is in now. And if you look at Mexico and you look at their occupancy data of the hospitals are empty. They have 25% occupancy. The death rates, the excess death rates, are pre-pandemic levels. And so you basically have removed fatalities and hospitalizations from an entire country. And so it's not a belief that we think it can end. We're seeing it play out in a number of countries. Panama is the same. Czechoslovakia, Czech Republic, Slovakia, all of them are showing these dramatic reductions in deaths and hospitalizations. So it's a highly effective treatment. We think that it can work with the vaccine. It's another tool, and it really needs to be employed.
So it's about diversifying the tools, actually.
Oh, you need more than the vaccines, right? So first of all, huge parts of the world are not going to see vaccines for quite some time. The efficacy of the vaccines against maybe developing variants is of a question. And there's also lots of vaccine hesitancy. The vaccines need another tool. We think that this is a bridge to vaccination as well as a safety net.
So when you see what's happening in India, how do you feel?
So I feel saddened that this information is not available. Now, that's changing. So if you look at what's happening in India this week, already two large states, so the state of Goa and Karnataka, they have already approved a test and treat strategy for their states, two large states. Uttar Pradesh, which is the most populous state in India, 234 million people, they're one of the most best performing regions in the world. And that's because they adopted ivermectin in early treatment back in August. And if you look at Uttar Pradesh right now, although their cases and deaths are rising, it's almost all driven from a migrant flux from Mumbai, where the outbreak started. But if you look at Uttar Pradesh, they're going to train stations, airports, bus stations. They're testing and treating, and they are controlling the pandemic. They're behaving. Their performance is far better than the rest of India. And so I think you're going to see India also gain control and start to look better. In fact, we're seeing early numbers that is already happening.
So, Dr. Pierre Corey, before we wrap, what is the takeaway from all this? What are your final thoughts?
So our final thoughts is that we're trying to call attention to a problem, is that there's not enough attention being placed on effective and available therapies. We're trying to call attention to that. There seems to be a focus around certain therapies and not others. And we feel responsible that patients and providers, especially providers, they need to be aware that there are tools available at their disposal. And the final thing I'll say is, you know, our peer-reviewed publications, we have a number of them in COVID. They should be looked at. You know, our website has a lot of information around ivermectin as well as our publications, and that's flccc.net. So if you want to learn more about what we think is going to be an important part of the solution to this pandemic, come to that website.
Dr. Pierre Corey, thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thank you, Lenore. Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Pierre Corey, Chief Medical Officer of the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance. On March 31st, WHO updated its living guidelines on COVID-19 therapeutics with a recommendation on ivermectin, stating that the current evidence on the use of ivermectin to treat COVID-19 patients is inconclusive. WHO recommends that the drug only be used to treat COVID-19 within clinical trials until more data is available. This applies to patients with any disease severity. It is time for a short break now. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. As COVID-19 rages around the world, women and girls continue to face intensified risks exacerbated by the pandemic. Now, campaigners say focused action is urgently needed in a growing number of low- and middle-income countries. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Kiama reports.
At a recent virtual global summit, more than 1,000 participants from around the world highlighted the need for targeted investments in pro-equity programs to combat the devastating social and economic effects of COVID-19. Speaking at the two-day event, leaders from several African countries, including Nigeria, Senegal, South Africa, Kenya, and Malawi, gave details about the devastation of the pandemic on the health of women, children, and adolescents. Awa Marie Kolsek is Minister of State to the President of Senegal.
Data collection on issues facing women and girls are irregular, but also the knowledge gap exists for new and emerging issues. Several countries like Rwanda or Senegal have made progress in this direction. Government and their partners need to make sure that the more vulnerable are effectively reached.
Globally, 350,000 women die each year in pregnancy or childbirth, according to the World Health Organization. The United Nations Population Fund says that in 2020, 12 million women experienced disruptions in family planning services due to the pandemic, with more than 1 million unintended pregnancies across 115 low- and middle-income countries. South Africa's Health Minister, Zweli Lawrence Mkhize, said that COVID-19 has devastated economies and affected social and community life, adding that women, children, and adolescents have been significantly affected. The He Summit, dubbed Lives in the Balance, was organized by several partners, including the Vaccine Alliance, known as Gavi, and the Partnership for Maternal, Newborn, and Child Health. It's a coalition of more than 1,000 organizations committed to protecting and advocating for the health, well-being, and the rights of women, children, and adolescents. Helen Clark is the board chair of the partnership and former Prime Minister of New Zealand.
To date, only 2% of the total number of vaccinations actually administered have been administered in Africa. And this geographic inequity puts at particular risk populations in the world's low and middle income countries where the greatest number of maternal, child and adolescent deaths occur. This very simple truth is this: none of us will be safe from COVID until we are all safe.
She called on the global community to diversify the production and distribution of vaccines, calling it urgent so that communities around the world can have access to more vaccines. Last year, the partnership issued a 7-point call to action in response to the devastating effects of COVID-19 on the health and well-being of women, children, and adolescents. Some say the pandemic has brought about massive shocks to already struggling health systems globally. Kenya, Nigeria, and Liberia are among the countries that have made commitments to protect this vulnerable group. Dr. Mercy Onsando is Chief Executive Officer of Health NGOs Network in Kenya.
Kenya, as we always front runners, we were not left behind, but we signed this commitment to improve and increase investment in the health system and social protection policies for women, children and adolescents as the world rebuilds from the impact of COVID-19 pandemic. We are very grateful that the government of Kenya did sign to this commitment. And not only did the government sign, but also committed funding.
The participants, including representatives from the civil society, the UN, academia, the private and public sectors, discussed solutions to mitigate the impacts of the pandemic. Wendy Moulton, a minister at the UK's Foreign Office, gave more details.
Sadly, if not unpredictably, the impact of COVID-19 on women, adolescents and children has been disproportionate and it has been profound. We also know that no country has been spared, so the only rational way forward is a way we find together. As global leaders, we have to advocate in the strongest possible terms for gender equality and for the needs of women and children to be at the heart of our efforts to rebuild.
Experts say the pandemic has disrupted the provision of life-saving services in the healthcare system, contributing to the erosion of sexual and reproductive health and rights of women and adolescents, and further exposing and exacerbating ethnic and gender inequalities everywhere. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
In South Africa, tens of thousands of people over age 60 are being vaccinated for COVID-19 after initial hitches in the country's immunization program. But scientists say the rollout has arrived much too late to prevent a potentially devastating third wave of coronavirus in the African nation hardest hit by the pandemic. Darren Taylor has more.
Medical experts want the government to reintroduce tougher restrictions in a desperate bid to avoid mounting infection rates and deaths.
We should be banning mass gatherings right now.
Professor Mark Mendelson is an infectious diseases specialist at the University of Cape Town.
Bringing down this allowance of 500 outdoors, 250 indoors, really to limit all mass gatherings, whether it be churches, casinos or any indoor areas, and stricter measures on indoor gatherings in particular, because these are the super spreader event areas and these are the ones that you really need to be very careful about.
He says South Africans need to ensure they spend as little time as possible indoors in places where there are a lot of people, such as shopping malls.
The same public health interventions that everyone is probably bored sick of, but this is what needs to be done. The social distancing, the hand hygiene, etc. This is what will limit the size of the third wave and indeed waves to come. Because unless we get our act together and really accelerate vaccination, we're looking at third, fourth, fifth, and maybe sixth waves.
Most provinces in South Africa are reporting steadily increasing infections and fatalities, but nowhere close to the rates in India. The rapid spread of COVID-19 there has forced its Serum Institute, the world's largest vaccine manufacturer, to stop exporting vaccines until the end of the year. This will also freeze supplies to the COVAX facility, which is supposed to provide vaccines to poorer countries. Mendelson says India has no choice but to look after its own for now.
The Serum Institute of India produces mainly the AstraZeneca vaccine. In South Africa, we're using the Johnson & Johnson, as you know, and mainly the Pfizer. But for Africa in general, this is not good news because COVAX is an important supply line for Africa in terms of the vaccine numbers.
But he says Africa, and in particular hard-hit countries like South Africa, should concentrate not just on vaccine numbers, but on getting however many shots they have into people's arms.
That's a massive undertaking in South Africa, and we have got to accelerate very, very rapidly now if we're going to impact over the next 12 to 18 months in South Africa.
At the beginning of the year, the government said it would immunize 40 million out of a population of 60 million by the end of the year. Its latest pledge is to vaccinate 5 million people by the end of June.
5 million by the end of June is aspirational. I'll be absolutely delighted if that happens. I think it's very unlikely to do so. You need to try and get to 60 to 70% of the population with immunity, and that would be through vaccination and through natural immunity.
Mendelssohn, like many other experts in South Africa, is calling on the government to allow other sectors to procure vaccines.
We need to think about decentralizing the whole process. You know, there are numerous outlets that could be involved. By just limiting it to government centers, as is planned, I think is a mistake.
But the state insists for order and safety to be maintained, it must control every aspect of the rollout. It's a stance that makes many very nervous, given the government's poor record on effective management. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Zimbabwe's hopes that it was bringing COVID-19 under control have been undercut by reports that the variant first reported in India has arrived. The country has put in place some measures to guard against a possible new wave at a time when vaccine rollout has been met with hesitancy. Travelers from India are expected to be tested upon arrival. Reporter Kudzai Zinafashe probes the hesitancy in the vaccine uptake.
Monica Mutsangwa is the Minister of Information. She gives the latest numbers on the COVID-19 situation in Zimbabwe.
As of 16th May 2021, a total of 591,808 people had received their first dose of COVID-19 vaccines, and about 222,450 had received their second dose. This is across the country. Members of the public are urged to go to their nearest health facility to receive their COVID-19 vaccines so that the country achieves the required herd immunity to control the spread of this global pandemic.
Zimbabwe started its vaccination drive in February. Experts are worried about the weak public interest. Dr. Norman Matara is with the group Zimbabwe Doctors for Human Rights.
I think the information about vaccines is being channeled out to the people, but at the same time, there is also a counter misinformation and disinformation as well, which is all over social media. So I think that is what is causing people to become hesitant in terms of taking up the COVID-19 vaccine. Although the information is coming out, we have also seen that some people are saying they actually do not trust the government, that they are going to provide them with safe and effective vaccines, even though that claim has no basis.
Tinotenda Chambwe is a Harare resident who is yet to receive his vaccine. He explains his hesitancy.
There are lots of stories that are coming out of these vaccinations. Yes, some have reacted to the vaccinations, so I do prioritize my health first. I also believe that government is not giving much information, so I can't even trust the government on the part of vaccinations. I also feel that the variants that are coming, like now we have the Indian variant. Yeah, how effective are the vaccines? That casts so much doubt on the effectiveness of the vaccines.
Matara says all opinion leaders need to rally behind the fight against misinformation. But while the government has been a formal source of information during the pandemic, citizens have developed mistrust of official pronouncements. And government critics claim the government has used lockdown measures to tamp down on dissent. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/VOA Health Chat and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lina Ahmadou in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and wash your hands more frequently, and strive to make every day a healthy day.